Bone Stealer? Screamed Tomo. Ghost Dwarf? Screamed Anna back. Tomo began cursing in Japanese, and Anna began cursing in Chinese. Alexandra couldn't understand any of it, but it sounded awful, and worse, both girls had drawn their wands. Alexandra had never seen her quiet, soft-spoken roommate fly into a rage like this.
Hello, and welcome back once again to the Remedial Magic Podcast. My name is Brady, and as always, joining me is my brother Baylor and our good friend Delbert, and we're back. I don't know why I say we're back every single week, but we're back. How's everybody doing?
Good.
I'm doing great. Just closed on my wife and I's first house, so that's pretty lit. Pretty exciting.
That is pretty exciting. Another thing that's exciting today is Delbert has gotten a haircut.
Finally.
Wow.
It's been a very long time.
It's been like more than a year, right?
Yeah. Longest my hair's ever been. Crap. And the person told me I should have grown it one more inch because apparently it was 7 inches long and 8 inches is what you need to donate hair.
And how did you respond to that?
I said, aw, shucks.
You didn't say, stop cutting my hair right now?
No, because she said it more than halfway done.
Oh, well, my point stands.
No.
Bummer.
You could have had the mullet.
It was halfway the other way. It was from here to the left.
Yeah, you could have had the side mullet.
Fine. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
It's no problem.
Disgusting comb over.
The half bowl cut, you know?
Oh, no.
Well, at any rate, welcome back to the Remedial Magic Podcast. This week on the show, we're talking about chapters 4 and 5 of Alexander Quick and the Lands Below. Last week, we took a one-week hiatus from talking about the book so that we could do a character discussion about Alexander Quick herself, which I thought was pretty fun. It's definitely our first time doing an episode in that style, and so because of that, it might be a little bit weird, but it's going to be worth checking out. So if you haven't listened to that yet, please go back and take a peek. But today we have chapters 4 and 5, and boy oh boy, are they interesting. They are really something. To be quite frank, there's a bit of overt racism that happens in this section.
A little bit problematic here.
A bit of overt racism, a bit of direct racism, you know. It's and we kind of see what may be cursing the American children around the country.
And a couple new insults that I want to add to my repertoire because I don't think they actually exist. But also, I'm a little worried that they might have some deep racist connotation because I know Inverarity writes pretty well. I just couldn't find anything based off of them.
At any rate, it's a very interesting section. And before we get into it, I wanted to open the floor to ask you guys if you have seen anything new about the Harry Potter world in the last week and a half or so.
Well, for me, this just tells you how long ago we recorded this episode, but today the news broke that the jury came back and in the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard case and awarded Johnny Depp I think $15 million. And so I know that they also awarded Amber Heard some money, but based on the settlement value, he was a big winner in that. And also he claims it saved his career. So the thing that got him fired from Fantastic Beasts was considered defamation or whatever the word is.
Yeah, I think we've all been sort of following that. In fact, Delbert, you and I were discussing the case before we started recording here. And first, I want to say that I find it remarkable that there was a person successful of pushing a defamation claim. And that's like got to be one of the most rare things to succeed with in the American justice system.
It's very difficult. I follow a couple lawyers on TikTok and they talk about how you not only have to have the intent, but you have to, like, knowingly make wrong remarks in an attempt to defame people. So you have to prove, like, all three facets of that. Otherwise, it's not going to actually go through.
I think it's good. Overall, for Johnny Depp, it's good. Obviously, the connection to Harry Potter is that he was Grindelwald for the first two Fantastic Beasts movies. He won't be coming back as Grindelwald, even if we get a fourth one, because Mads Mikkelsen is in place now. But that whole court case has been extremely interesting to follow. It's been almost like reality TV at times.
It was a circus, man. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of stuff pointing both ways. I don't want to say that I think Johnny Depp is completely innocent of anything, but I do believe now that Amber Heard is probably more at fault than he was by a long shot.
Sure, and the results of, like, the jury's decision about the settlement reflect that as well. When everything's taken into account, what it works out to is Amber Heard owing Johnny Depp $8.35 million, which, you know, that'll be on her to pay. And I'm kind of glad that it's over with, because it's been, like, dominating YouTube and everything else I look at on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's insane how much traction this got when there's still a war happening in Europe.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There was still a war. There was still, you know, that unfortunate shooting in several places.
Texas, I mean, there's been several Buffalo. Since
this case started. But yeah, it's been pretty much the running theme of TikTok is to pretty much shit on the court case, because some of the witnesses that were brought up, even Johnny Depp, even Amber Heard, I mean, their testimony is just comedy. I'm not gonna lie,
very bizarre. And it's, I don't know, like, it was a spectacle similar to when the entire Wisdom Gummo brought Harry in for a full-fledged trial about underage magic, and then Dumbledore just shows up and summons himself a nice lazy boy recliner and tells Fudge what for. So it was just bizarre. I'm glad that it's over with.
There's one facet of that trial. I know this isn't a Amber Heard, Johnny Depp court trial, but... or podcast, but...
It's the first 20 minutes. We have time.
There was a witness that was recommended to Amber's lawyers to bring in and testify. So her lawyers Googled the person, found out, hey, look, this person lives in Virginia, which is where the case was happening this whole time. So asked him to come testify. Turns out there's more than one person with the same name in the field, and the person she was recommended was someone who taught at Stanford. So she just brought a completely irrelevant witness to the stand to testify, who testified in Johnny's favor.
That's really exciting news.
But yeah.
You know? You gotta love it all the way around.
Like I said, a circus.
A circus indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of a circus, the future of the Harry Potter franchise sort of as a whole has been a bit of a circus, really the last 2 or 3 years, right? Between J.K. Rowling's transphobic commentary, between the mixed and then really poor reviews of the Fantastic Beasts franchise. You even have the stars of the Harry Potter series coming out and speaking against the creator of Harry Potter. It's been kind of a disaster, but in the last couple of weeks, there's been some news about the future of Harry Potter, and Warner Brothers has a new CEO. His name is David Zaslav, and not only does he think Harry Potter still has a place in Warner Brothers' plans going forward, he's doubling down. And so there's been meetings over the past couple weeks with JKR, with the Warner Brothers creative team, about how they can continue creating from the Harry Potter universe and making new products. And so for me, that is extremely exciting, because if Harry Potter stopped with Fantastic Beasts, I would be highly disappointed.
I don't think they will, but I really hope that they George Lucas the deal and just offer JKR $5 billion and say, here you go, give us all the rights. Because that would be a very profitable adventure, I think.
I mean, look at Star Wars. I mean, once they did that, the amount of content and all of the other good stuff that they put out you know, that they've been putting out. Like, that's what the fans are really eating up at this time. It's not just the original six movies or however many movies they're up to now. So if they did that with Harry Potter, I could see all kinds of different stuff happening.
Well, and it's not as if Harry Potter has lost momentum. Like, the struggles of Fantastic Beasts and even the controversy surrounding J.K. Rowling hasn't slowed people's love of Harry Potter down very much. And there's also still things to build on. You know, we just had the reunion not too long ago, and that was extremely successful. We have the new game coming up that has as much, if not more, hype than any game I've seen in maybe the last 5 years. So there's a lot moving forward, and so I'm really, really excited about what is going to come next, at least according to the fact that there's been meetings held and conversations held about what can happen next. And I'm glad that the CEO is betting big. I think betting big on Harry Potter is successful. And Delbert, I think you're right when you say they just need to try to get all the rights away from J.K. Rowling, because that will open things up like almost infinitely.
Well, yeah. I mean, you look at Baylor talked about Star Wars, George Lucas, everything like that. You talk about the new shows that have come out, Mandalorian. George Lucas didn't write any of that, I don't think, and look how successful it was. So, I mean, if you open this up to other writers and, you know, creative groupthink in Warner Brothers, I'm sure you can come out with plenty of series, plenty of shows, movies, maybe animated stuff as well, that will trump anything from the Fantastic Beasts so far.
Conversely, you look at the Harry Potter series and Fantastic Beasts series and Cursed Child, you know, J.K. Rowling was one of the main, if not the main writer on all that stuff, and look how not good it was. So definitely doing that group thing, that group think thing that you're talking about, Delbert, would, I could only see a benefit from that.
So with that being said, it's quick prediction time. What do you guys think is the next thing to come out of the Harry Potter universe? For me, I honestly believe we're getting a TV adaptation of The Cursed Child. There is so much speculation surrounding that. All of a sudden, it feels like it's got a ton of momentum right now. And I think if they're trying to get something out quick to get our minds off of Fantastic Beasts, they already have the skeleton of Cursed Child that they can work from. And really, obviously we know reading it in the screenplay was a struggle, but the play has been enormously successful, and that type of writing can easily be pushed into the TV format because it makes more sense when you can see it rather than just reading it anyways.
I would say that would be probably be the easiest thing that they could do, is to push out Cursed Child into the multimedia platform. I also could see like a mini series on either the founding, the Hogwarts founders, or the Marauders. Just a fun little, you know, 4 or 5 episode series, kind of something like that, that they can throw together quick. But I also could see them not doing that, just because that's something that probably could be easily expanded on. And so they'd want like a good core of actors and actresses and whatever else. So I would probably say The Cursed Child after I just talked myself out of my idea about the other stuff.
I have two opinions on this. One, if the rights stay with JKR, I'm on Baylor's side here, saying the four founders. If she were to relinquish the rights and sell them, I would be extremely happy with just a completely original thing with no characters we've ever heard of.
Yeah, and I think that's a great idea, too. At some point, you're going to need that anyways,
yeah.
I think. Now, what I think would hype the fan base up the most is if they came out tomorrow and said, in 2024, expect the first season of the television adaptation of the Harry Potter series.
Yeah, with Amazon with a $100 billion budget.
Like if they came out and did something like that, people would lose their minds. And then they could have, or they could even push that a couple years further, and then you use something like The Cursed Child, which has already been developed, as a little carrot on a stick to keep people on board until that time comes. But either way, if there's more Harry Potter coming, that's very exciting for everybody, I think. Anybody in this universe that's still here through the controversy, through Fantastic Beasts, they just want more Harry Potter, right? So it's exciting times, especially for us when we're still doing this podcast in 10 years and we have finally finished the last Alexander Quick book and need to do something else.
I'll tell you what, if Warner Brothers gets all the rights to the Wizarding World, I'll make it my life's ambition to start working there, become the head of creative, and purchase Alexandra Quick for a movie series.
All right.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
Wow.
You, those of you in the Discord, start petitioning Inverarity now.
We already have the cast. We just need to de-age all of them.
That's true. If you want to send donations to us to help us with this fund to purchase Alexandra Quick and the rights to create a TV adaptation out of it, you can send those where, Delbert? Where can you send anything like that?
I don't know if we have any way of receiving donations.
No,
at the
you can send it through social media and email. That's what I'm getting at.
Oh, I see. Well, if you want to send your donation through email, it's remedialmagicpodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to send it through Instagram or Twitter, it's @_RMpodcast.
Wonderful.
Speaking of which, we have an email.
We do?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. When I checked, the only thing I saw was spam.
We have a subscription invoice for Norton Antivirus.
Oh.
So somebody bought Norton on the podcast account.
That's the email I saw.
Yeah.
That's the spam email from Norton. And I know it's spam because I got exactly the same email on my personal email.
Gotcha. Address. Okay. Yeah. I was wondering, because I assumed none of us still use Norton, of all things, for antivirus, right?
I'm a human and I don't use an antivirus.
I was going to say, I don't use an antivirus at all.
Right.
About once a year, I remember to have the one that comes built in on Microsoft computers.
Yeah.
Just run.
Right.
Just to make sure, but I don't use an antivirus.
Yeah. Also, if the pricing on that is correct, I think it's like $400. No, thank you.
With all that being said, I think we can get into our main discussion. As a reminder, we are talking about Alexander Quick and the Lands Below chapters 4 and 5 this week. And this is an interesting little arc. A deep dive into a brand new cultural controversy. And so, with that being said, I think we can get into our main discussion. So, Delbert, I think this week you said you would do the summary, the sub 60-second-ish summary.
Pressure. Okay, I was just going to read all 2 chapters, just every word.
That's fine. That's not a problem. But, Delbert, if you would go ahead and summarize these 2 chapters for us before we get started, that would be much appreciated.
Perfect. Will do. Our first chapter, chapter 4, is titled Cultures. It's focused primarily about Alex returning to school, meeting up with her friends, finding the fillings from the vacancies left in book 1, new teachers for her classes, new janitor, since Ben Journey had a unfortunate final semester, and a new student who causes some conflicts with Anna named Tojo Matsuka, I believe. Also not to be missed are some of the ASPEW meetings are getting started. Alex finally decides to join that officially. And then Anna and Tomo seem not to get along, starting a fist fight or getting involved in Muggle fisticuffs. Chapter 5 is titled New Wands, and it starts on the way to the dean's office. What else is new with our Alex Quick journey? Alex, Tomo, and Anna all get accused by the dean of bigotry and fighting, and punished accordingly, with Alex and Anna being assigned to take part in the J-Rock squad. They have to have their classes changed to practical magical exercise, and that's basically the entire chapter.
All right. One point of clarification, the new character's name is Tomo.
Oh, what did I say?
Tojo.
Oop. Sorry.
It's fine. Tomo.
Did I say it? I said it twice. Did I mess it up both times?
I think I only heard it once.
Okay.
And you only messed it up that time.
Nice. Fantastic.
But these two chapters are crazy.
Yeah.
They're like pretty intense with, what is it? I guess Anna's a 12-year-old now. And then this Tomo character is 11 since she's a sixth grader. And they hate each other. And their basis for hating each other is that one of them is Chinese and the other one is Japanese.
I'm curious about the historical friction that these two cultures have against each other in the Wizarding World.
Yeah, I'm curious about that as well. We don't really get much explanation for this difference. We do find out, I guess, in regards to these two, that part of the friction is that when the Confederation was formed, the Chinese population willingly joined the Confederation, and then the Japanese population wanted to be a little bit more isolationist, and they kind of run things their own way. But that's about all the history we get. And so when Tomo is introduced as this character who just blatantly doesn't like Anna, even though she's never seen her before, my first reaction to that was like, I just thought that she was like a sixth grader who was being put up for a dare, until all of a sudden there is some extremely racially prejudiced things being said back and forth between Anna and Tomo. So I'm excited when we get to that part of the discussion, but we start off with Alex returning to school, and it's fairly similar to the way she returns to school the first time, like after winter break, even with her not really sure if she's going to miss her mom, and her mom not necessarily playing the part of a mom who's sending her kid away for the next several months. I just think it's interesting that Alex sort of reflects on the fact that she hasn't brought her dad up to her mom at all, still up to this point, and she regrets it, but she also, it seems like she cares more that she's going back than she does about what she's leaving behind in Larkin Mills.
It even says that she just wants to get out of Larkin Mills as fast as possible. So you can definitely tell that the summer didn't go quite as well as Alex wanted it to go.
And that makes sense, considering she spent some of her summer at a school for witch hunting as a witch.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Indeed.
She definitely is excited to get back to school. And so when the Charmbridge bus shows up, she even like makes note, or at least it's made clear to the reader, that Alex doesn't even think she's going to miss her mom that much, which I guess from when she got back to Larkin Mills after her first year at Charmbridge, that is a big time change in attitude. Because when she got back, she was at the very least excited to speak to her mom so she could get some answers about this Abraham Thorne guy. So the fact that now she doesn't even think she's going to miss her mom really indicates how poorly the summer was. And obviously, I don't want to go out and say Alex is correct all the time, because she's not. But if I had had to endure a summer like that, I probably would have been pretty pissed off too. I would not have been super happy about it. However, she does get on the bus, and she rides with Darla and Angelique, and then David, which is fine. I find it interesting that Anna and Constance and Forbearance are already at the academy. They're already at Charmbridge when she gets on the bus here. I know this is how it was in her first year too, but why are some students arriving so much earlier than other students? Did we discuss this in the first book at all?
I thought they had mentioned that it was like a regional thing. So like they picked up the farther away students first, because I thought that like the beginning of the school year was like a week long. There was like a week long gathering of all the students throughout the country.
Yeah, that's probably a good explanation. I guess I think of their trip to the Goblin Market where everybody's there, and it seems like it's not a problem to get everybody there. Why do they all of a sudden need a week to get all the students into one place when they easily did it for the Goblin Market in one day?
I kind of thought, and I could be wrong here or even pulling from books in the future, so I don't want to say too much, but I thought there was something about once Constance and Forbearance went to the Goblin Market, they just went to Charmbridge after that.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely potential that that's correct.
Maybe I just made that up, or maybe it's from a different book, but I thought I had that in my head for some reason.
It sounds right for some reason.
Yeah.
It does sound right for some reason.
Like, they all meet up there, and then the kids close get to go home a couple days, but the kids that are from further away just go to the school.
That could definitely be a possibility. Well, if that's the case, then what are Anna and Constance and Forbearance doing in this free time at Charmbridge?
Enjoying their time without Alex, for sure.
Apparently, for Anna in this chapter, it's researching enemy cultures.
Yeah, evidently.
Enemy cultures, holy moly.
It's just, at any rate, Alex eventually makes it to Charmbridge, and she goes across the Invisible Bridge, this time without incident. So, we're not going to get a repeat of that storyline here, but I thought it was interesting that she was a little apprehensive. She was, like, preparing for the bridge to disappear, like opening the cage so Charlie could save her again if necessary, or whatever else. And in one paragraph, she's doing that. And in the very next paragraph, it describes her as being perfectly confident that nothing would go wrong. So maybe it's just a mistake in writing, or maybe it's just a slip in self-confidence for Alex that got translated onto paper that way.
I think it's some nice juxtaposition of, I feel like I'm super safe and confident because Ben Journey's here, or not here. But also, who else is out there? So it's being prepared while also not being worried, I guess.
That's true. Do you guys think Alex feels safe in general coming back to Charmbridge?
Man, I don't know. It's like the same almost as Harry Potter, because like every time he went back to school, he got almost got killed at the end of the year. So you'd think that he would have been scared to go back. But I honestly think, just given how Alex reacted just at the Goblin Market, like being able to see that those things were real again, even though she, you know, with her being gone all summer from the magical world, I think she was so excited to be back that she didn't even think about it until she got to the Invisible Bridge, which reminded her of Ben Journey and what he did last year.
Yeah. I'm very interested to see what Alex gets up to this year, or what causes her a problem this year. Maybe there won't be any problems this year, and it will just be an entire book about being a student at a wizarding school. But I think it's kind of fun that there is some new characters introduced in this chapter. We have a couple of new teachers. We have a replacement for Ben Journey. The replacement for Ben Journey is a woman. Her name is Libby Gale, and she is described as being like rosy faced, and that's about all we get in terms of a description of her character. And I can't tell you guys why, but for some reason, when she gets introduced and I'm reading it, my brain automatically goes, that's where Dolores Umbridge went.
Oh no.
I don't know why.
Oh
there's
no,
absolutely nothing to connect it, but my brain today, when I was rereading this chapter, went, oh, Dolores Umbridge is as at Charmbridge now.
That would be very sad.
I don't like to think about that woman.
I'm sure the detentions will be fun, if that's the case.
What do you guys think? Is Libby Gale going to pose a mortal threat to anybody in this book?
Well, they're one for one so far with custodians, so...
I can't say it, because I thought Ben Journey was relatively harmless in the first book until the end, so I don't know. I would say, just given how we don't hear really a big description about her, I think that she'll probably be insignificant.
Sure.
And
that's just my guess.
Here's a long-term prediction for you. Is she a former Death Eater or a government employee?
Yeah. I'm going to go out on a limb and say neither.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be a weird premise if this entire series, the main villain was always the custodian?
Yeah.
Every single year. He's like, the custodian.
It almost feel like a Hardy Boys novel or something.
We take off Libby Gale's mask and it's just Ben Journey.
It's survived the gunshot.
The other two new teachers that we get introduced to as Alex begins classes, and one of her classes is a brand new class called Magical Ecology, which is, I think, is the analog for Care of Magical Creatures. And it sounds like a cool class just from the name, if you know what ecology is, studying animals and their habits and the way they move and reproduce and things like that. And the person who teaches that is Mr. Fledgefield. And unfortunately, we find out pretty quick that in Alex's case, magical ecology is not going to be that interesting because all they're doing is studying plants, I suppose. For me, it seems interesting still.
I did find it interesting how Sasquatches were mentioned in that thing. Like he said that students aren't going to be asked to go find a Sasquatch in their first week. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah, so it sounds like perhaps there's a little bit more planning going into this magical creatures-based class at Charmbridge than there was at Hogwarts, where Dumbledore just told Hagrid, "Have at it, pal," and Hagrid brought in his own chimeras that he made himself and risked the lives of students every day. Here it seems like you're starting with like foundational skills, and then as you get older, you get to interact with more and more dangerous beasts when you're capable. It's like almost as if a little bit of planning goes a long ways towards safety in the magical world.
Hagrid's a great friend, not a great teacher.
No, he's not.
It's not only planning in the book by the teacher itself, but it's planning by the author of the book.
I agree 100%. I don't know, honestly, if you ask J.K. Rowling why she made Hagrid the Care of Magical Creatures teacher, if she would have an answer other than I needed a sympathetic character. Like,
yeah,
I don't know if there's a reason.
He wasn't originally, right?
Right, that's my point. Like, why would a person like Dumbledore ever pick Hagrid over a character like Grubbly Plank, who actually knew how to teach students?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's that, and then there's the whole thing of like caring for the creatures themselves, like how we saw it with Hagrid. They just jumped in and were like, "All right, take care of these things. You don't know anything about them or what to do at all, but take care of them." Whereas this one, they're actually, it makes sense, you know, that they have the basics first. So just bravo to Inverardi by using his brain when writing this part.
It's a little bit tangential, but what was the point of the Care of Magical Creatures class taking up so much time in the books? Was there a purpose for that?
All it really served was a friction point between Harry and the various antagonists throughout the book.
It like drove the storyline of Hagrid being gone searching for giants a little bit, but they were already friends with him.
I would say it was useful in book 4. Because there were a lot of those creatures in the maze and the dragon challenge and everything. But you're right. We spent a lot of time there. I guess Buckbeak was important for book 5 and 3.
I just think that, like, Harry could have met Buckbeak regardless of Hagrid being involved.
That's true.
You know? Or wouldn't it have been a much better use of Hagrid's time for when Harry's in the Triwizard Tournament for Harry to go, "Hey, can you teach me about these creatures? Can you tell me about them?" Rather than Harry bowing to a hippogriff, and as soon as it bows back, Hagrid just tosses Harry on top of it and says, "Go fly around, have fun." I don't know. At any rate, Mr. Fledgefield sounds like he's very, very qualified to teach magical ecology.
Right.
And unfortunately, we only know him for about 3 paragraphs.
Yep.
The other new teacher is Miss Hart, who is described as being an attractive young witch who is unable to keep control of the class because the boys in class are much more interested in her than they are in the stuff they're supposed to be learning. So,
no experience at all in our high school.
How unfortunate.
Kind of situation. None at all.
Nope. None at all. None at all.
I will say, basic magical theory, this is a continuation of the class that Shirtlift taught to the 6th graders in Alex's first year. And Alex is actually disappointed to not have Shirtlift be teaching her this class. When she walks in and sees that instead that it's Miss Hart. And I think that's a good reminder to the reader of how Alex feels about Shirtliff. I think she respects her quite a bit.
I think behind Ben Journey, Shirtliff was probably her second favorite person at the school until obviously Ben Journey tried to kill her. But, you know, she was one of the first people to show her respect, I think. So it makes sense.
So we didn't find out too much about her classes aside from what we've talked about, and that in magical social studies, which is a class that Alex absolutely hates, things have been whitewashed. So it's nice that there's consistency between Muggle education and wizarding education in this way, because I guarantee in our social studies classes, things were very much whitewashed as well. David is especially upset about this, and so we see some consistency in character there as well, where David is continuing to be the person who is most concerned with social, how should I say it? Like, social justice, essentially.
Right.
Right. I do wonder what this whitewashing is like. If it's whitewashing, maybe not necessarily racially, but more so that the Confederation is only putting out social studies books that reflect good upon them.
Probably. That makes sense.
Well, I think we discussed that, too, in the first book, when it is in regards to the book with Abraham Thorne mentioned, and how we all talked about how these are in a school which is sanctioned by the Confederacy, or Confederation, sorry. And so it's probably whatever they want to be known about that character.
Yeah. And to be fair, it could be both, because we haven't exactly heard of too many minority characters that are in power yet, as we've read this story. But those are Alex's new classes. More importantly, in this chapter, because we're talking about chapter 4 right now, Anna and this new character, Tomo, hate each other. And it seems to be very culturally, if not racially, based. Anna is, of course, Chinese. And the new character, Tomo, is Japanese. And they have a confrontation in the cafeteria the very first day. Or maybe not the first day, but one of the first days of the school year, where Anna's getting food and Tomo just charges right into her and then continues on as if nothing happened. And this leads to a domino effect of, at least when considering Anna, pretty massive scale.
Yeah.
Right? You have Anna proceed to show up one night in the dormitory room missing her fingernails. And I don't know how you guys felt about this conversation, but I was disgusted. Because Alex asks Anna what's wrong with her fingers, and Anna finally tells her that she lost her fingernails because of a fingernail pulling charm. Not something that just makes them disappear. Something that pulls them off of your body. What in the world?
Yeah.
Anna was definitely a bit stoic, you know, for having 10 fingernails ripped out of her hand.
Isn't that like a very successful Moments method before. Of torture?
Listen, here's my experience with this. I've had a nail removed. I had 4 shots of numbing something, and it was still very unpleasant. And my other example is in the show Ozark. Haha, topical with constance and forbearance. That is a form of torture. With one nail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Just bizarre. Like, so these two things happened to Anna. Now, at this point, what did you guys think? Did you think Anna was just going to be Anna and, like, take it and be the bigger person? Because that's kind of what I thought initially when reading this. Like, she seemed like she was reacting in a very passive way.
Yeah, I kind of thought she was... I think it definitely was, she was trying to keep Alex out of it. But also it was very Anna-like to just be like, oh, don't worry about it. I'm okay. They'll regrow eventually, you know. But then the weird thing to me was the threat that she threw out, because all throughout the first book and thus far in the second book, we never had seen anything like that from quiet old Anna, you know, stoic Anna, the person that Alex needed to be more like. So, that kind of threw me for a loop at the time, and I honestly thought, oh, it'll get handled by a teacher or something like that.
Well, I like this too, because this is like, ooh, here we go. I'm really getting points with the English crowd today. Juxtaposed to the first book, because here we have Anna plotting against someone without telling Alex, which is in Anna's entire like problem with Alex during the first book. Mm-hmm. That she's going on all these adventures and not telling Anna what's happening.
It's really interesting, and it gets more interesting because all of a sudden a school assembly is called to basically say, hey, do not throw dangerous hexes and curses at your classmates. Do not do that. If you do that, you will be expelled, essentially, is the message that Dean Grimm sends at this second assembly of the chapter. And then Alex goes to an ESPYU meeting because she has time to for the first time since she's not in detention. And she finds out that Tomo is in the infirmary because somebody cast a curse at her called the Medusa's Curse, which essentially causes your own hair to try to strangle you. So the response to this sixth grade girl doing things to Anna was to try to kill her.
Yeah.
An attempt on her life.
Little excessive.
What in the world?
That was pretty bizarre, I'm not going to lie. Definitely came out of left field.
I will say, I did not believe that this was Anna when I read this. I was like, there's no way Anna tried to kill somebody. Maybe she tried to, maybe she did do it and didn't understand the ramifications of what she was doing. But there's no way Anna was out trying to actually murder a person.
Yeah, it was concerning, you know, because we saw her meet with those other Chinese American students the night before or whatever, the night before the assembly. And so I find it weird that Alex didn't go over there and try to confront Anna and just see what was going on, because she was also suspicious, especially after that threat.
It was weird that Alex stayed out of that when she saw Anna meeting with these two other students.
But yeah, I'm with you guys. I think going to the extremes of doing something that try to kill somebody after they run into you in the cafeteria, one, obviously, is way, obviously, an overreaction, first of all. But second, points to some very underlying stuff, which obviously we find out later in the chapter what happened. What, you know, what, why they are fighting or whatever they're doing.
We do find out, and in fact, we find out pretty quick because Alex goes to confront Anna about this and basically say, hey, what is going on? Why is this happening? And she finds out from Anna, she doesn't really find out a lot of detail, but she finds out that Chinese and Japanese wizarding families don't get along with each other. That the Chinese wizarding community willingly joined the Confederation, the Japanese wizarding community stayed out of it. And wants to be a little bit more independent. And we find out that Japanese wizarding families are collectively called Magikai. And they're one of the independent wizarding cultures. So they're another one to add to our list. We've got the Magikai now, as well as the Ozarkers, as well as the people that practice voodoo. As well as, I don't know if we've got any others for sure. Off the top of the head, but they do also in this chapter mention like Native Americans. So there's another one. And so we have yet another culture introduced in this series. And this one comes with some pretty, pretty serious ramifications in terms of actual prejudice being played out in front of the reader's eyes. It also doesn't stop after this Medusa's Curse thing.
No.
Right, Tomo almost dies, and rather than backing down as a normal person might after they had their life attempted on, Tomo again confronts Anna, and they get into an argument in the hallway in which they exchange insults. And these are the insults you were talking about earlier, Delbert. And Tomo calls Anna a bone stealer, and Anna responds by calling Tomo a ghost dwarf. And then they get into muggle fisticuffs.
Yeah, because Alex actually disarms them. So
she does.
Tries
yeah.
to stop it from happening, and it just, you know, turns into a brawl.
Now, I don't know about you guys. Far be it from me to say that these are just insults that Inverarity made up to include in the book. I did Google them. We did a little bit of research before the episode started, Delbert, and we didn't find anything relevant linking these to a specific culture or not. But I gotta tell you, these are some serious... these insults are interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I love Ghost Dwarf. I mean, I'm gonna be crucified if it's an actual, like, super racist term or something.
You're gonna get canceled.
True. But without knowing it and with doing 3 minutes of Google research on it, it's a fun insult.
It is.
Yeah.
How about we just throw out, if you know of why these are insults, write in.
True.
Please do. I would love to know why Ghost Dwarf and Bone Stealer are insults. And if they're related specifically to Asian communities, I really want to know why, because they seem hyper-specific in that case.
Yeah, and it's something like... Mm-hmm. You talked about how this chapter seems to have paralleled, like, normal Muggle life as far as whitewashing history and everything. There is certainly in real life also some Chinese-Japanese tension, especially, you know, in the events after World War II. Mm-hmm. So maybe these are insults that developed in those cultures, and Inverarity studied that. So, I mean, they might exist, but I've certainly never heard of them.
Yeah, me either. And bottom line here, Alex does the right thing. She witnesses this happen, and rather than letting them curse each other and get in a bunch of trouble, she disarms them. And then when they go at it with their fists, Alex gets in between them and tries to help them, or tries to stop the fight. And for all of her efforts, where does she end up once again? In the dean's office. So
yeah,
that really wraps up the events of chapter 4. Because it was a big chapter, but it just sucks, right, for Alex. This is maybe the first time, not the first time, but we see her actively trying to do the right thing, to stop a fight, to follow the rules more so than Anna is. And here she is in the dean's office anyways.
Yep. I was pretty disappointed, because even if she, you know, they say, oh, Alex wasn't doing anything, like, there's no way Shirtliff or the dean will believe anybody. So she kind of screwed herself.
Girl who cried wolf.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing is, about Alex is that I'm guessing coming into the year, all the staff was already on high alert looking for her to mess up.
Oh, yeah.
So just by de facto of her being there, she was going to get in trouble.
I wonder if Dean Grimm told the new custodian, hey, watch out for this girl. She kind of killed the last one.
Knowing Dean Grimm, she probably did, and then didn't tell her the whole story.
So moving on to chapter 5, they all meet with Dean Grimm, Alex, Anna, and Tomo. And Dean Grimm immediately kind of starts implying that Alex had something to do with it, and Anna says, no, it wasn't her fault. And so Dean Grimm says, okay, then whose fault was it? Also, tell me about the Medusa's curse that got cast, essentially. There's a lot of stuff being said without being said here. And eventually it all boils down to Dean Grimm just saying, you know what? I don't tolerate bigotry. I don't think that you two, referring to Anna and Tomo, even understand the conflict between your two cultures. And you know what? I think you're just parroting whatever nonsense you hear at home. And I was like, cheering on Dean Grimm at this point. Yeah. I was like, yeah.
Excellent scene, yeah.
Yep, yeah, that's what I was referencing earlier when I said we reveal what is the issue with American children.
It's just, like, it's got to be that, right? I mean, is it realistic to expect that Anna and Tomo understand the motivations that are causing this tension? Or is it just that Anna has sat at home listening to her dad talk about the Magikai, and Tomo has sat at home listening to her family talk about the Chinese population, and they're just bringing that tension with them?
They have to be, right? And the weird thing is that, Anna's dad talks that way kind of about Muggles. I mean, he's anti-Muggle in every way of the word, except the fact that he married a Muggle. I mean, they can't even have Muggle stuff in the house, but Anna is still, like, comfortable around Muggles. So, I mean, whatever this conflict is between the Chinese Americans and the Japanese Americans, these two cultures, like, it must be intense enough that Anna is actually bringing it to school with her.
Do you think Anna would have reacted in this way at all? Like, do you think if Anna had seen Tomo from across the cafeteria and Tomo hadn't done this to Anna, would Anna have done anything?
Maybe not done anything other than...
retaliatory only?
Just a dissenting attitude, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't really see Anna pulling, like, the first move in something like this.
Last chapter was just so out of character for Anna.
Yeah.
Just so out of character for what we've seen from her.
It's one of those things, though, like, right now, we still have, we mentioned it earlier, but the Ukraine-Russian conflict slash war going on. In 50 years, the people that fought in this war on the Ukrainian side are going to be telling their kids about how much they hate the Russians and everything, even though most of the Russians that are making this decision, including Putin, will be dead by then. So they'll be preaching about how horrible Russians are for a class of people that aren't even existent.
It's a really good point, actually.
So, I mean, even though it's being parroted at home, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's, like, untrue in a sense. It's probably just ill-timed, basically.
Yeah, right.
Dean Grimm basically says, no more bigotry. If you do anything else like this, you'll be gone. And then she punishes them each. She sends Tomo off to the sixth grade dean to be punished. That's the last time we see Tomo in this little conversation. And then she tells Alex and Anna, oh, you guys, you're joining the J-Rock. You're going to go with Miss Shirtliff, and you're going to learn how to behave yourselves. And Alex is mad because it means no more magical ecology. And Anna is scared of what her dad's going to say. Maybe rightfully so. But before we look at them in J-Rock, since it's the last time we see Tomo, perhaps we should cast Tomo, Delbert, since that's the person you chose this time around.
True, yes. Indeed. I chose that, and you definitely didn't cast it before I chose that, because it was pretty obvious that's who we were going to cast, I think. So, for the casting of Tomo, Baylor, how about you go first?
All right, so, full disclosure, as I normally do, I Google something and find an actor or actress that fits that. So, I Googled the top 15 Japanese actresses. And pulled up an article from the Japan Insider. And number 10 on that list is a actress who's 19 years old currently, but obviously probably could be aged down. And apologies for this name. I'm probably going to butcher it. Kaya Kiyohara.
I think that's correct.
I think that's correct, too.
Nice, nice. And just to kind of give you guys an idea of what she's aired in, because I thought it was kind of funny, she was in a TV series called Okari Mone, which aired during the first half of 2021, and she played a heroine who aims to become a weather forecaster.
Okay.
And
all right.
Yeah, since I'm a weather nerd, I thought that was kind
of
neat.
Yeah, so the Japanese female equivalent of you.
Indeed, I am the American heroine who's always on a quest to become a weather forecaster.
Nice, nice. Brady, how about you go next?
I cast for Tomo Nozomi Ohashi. And I tried desperately to get a current child actor for this. Once again, we're having the problem of casting child actors. That being said, I went with Nozomi Ohashi specifically because she was in a movie called Bread of Happiness. It got a 7.7.
Bread of Happiness?
Bread of Happiness. 7.7 out of 10 on IMDb. 67% of Google users liked it. Come on. Does it get much better?
In Harry Potter world? No, it doesn't.
It's about a bakery restaurant named Manny on the shores of Lake Toya in Hokkaido.
Okay, so it's a Japanese film?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's who I chose. I would be lying if I said I had ever heard of Nozomi Ohashi before, but that is the world of trying to choose culturally accurate child actors.
Yeah,
Indeed.
So
seems a fit for me.
For my casting, I've decided that this year I'm going to try to pick people I know, even if it means de-aging them, or this year, this season. And I don't know a lot of Japanese actresses. I don't know any full Japanese actresses. I mean, I'm uncultured, I suppose. This chapter helped me. but one of the part Japanese actresses I do know featured prominently in the Fast Five podcast season 2 is Devon Aoki as Suki, I believe is her name in that role. She is the daughter of the founder of Benihana and brother of DJ Steve Aoki.
That's nice.
And she's half Japanese and half German. So, you know, maybe not exactly a great portrayal here. But, like I said, only Japanese actors I know.
Sure. Well, of the three, that's the only one that I recognize as well. Right. So.
And, I mean, to be fair, I think Tomo, with how she's been acting already, is probably somewhat of like a tomboyish type character. And I do get that vibe from Suki in Fast and the Furious.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, why not?
Could be possibly played that
that's
way.
That's fair.
All right. So that's the casting for Tomo.
Good castings.
We'll see more of her, certainly, moving forward, and maybe that will help us decide which of these three actresses is the best fit, if we do that at the end of the season. But we do need to talk about Alex and Anna being assigned to be part of the J-Rock as punishment. Specifically, what we need to talk about is, why is this Maximilian guy so obsessed with Alex?
He's a creep.
He is staring at her.
He's a weird guy.
He's staring at her every time she looks around.
He's also been around, too, right? Like, when Alex stops the fight between Anna and Tomo, he's the one that grabs Alex when Shirtloof shows up.
He is, yes. And he's in Grundy's there. He's staring at Alex there, too.
Yep.
So, what is his deal? I guess I should ask you, Baylor.
Well, my thought was just, and I think there's something else there, but I haven't quite pinpointed it yet. But my biggest thing is, I think these storm cloaks, I can't remember what they're called, whatever they are, they seem to have a resentfulness towards Abraham Thorne. And I saw that a lot when they're getting fit for their uniforms. They're sent with Beatrice Hawthorne. And she says, you know, Alex, we all know your father's Abraham Thorne. You're not going to get away with anything. Don't even try it. We're keeping an eye on you, that kind of stuff. And so, for some reason, and it might be because they're in the J-Rock, I don't know, they seem to be keyed in on Alex because her father is Abraham Thorne, and they don't want her to replicate what he's done, maybe? I don't know, something like that.
So you're saying that this Maximilian guy's attention is a byproduct of the whole group being suspicious of Alex more so than anything else?
I think initially, but like I said, I do think that there's something else underneath the surface. But I just don't quite know what it is. I don't know if it's like a love interest or something else like that.
Oh, no.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully not. Yeah. I just remembered that they're like 6 years apart. So hopefully not that, but, you know, something like that. I'm not sure.
You know what they say? Alex is the new Darla.
Oh, no. I will say, my thought on this the first time I read this, especially this scene with the Hawthorne girl, was that because of how the timeline adds up, like, Alex was, what, 12 years old in this? So it's likely that Thorne was active 12 to 15 years ago in his plotting against the government.
Sure.
So my thought is that this guy might have been orphaned by Abraham Thorne.
Oh, that's interesting, too.
Yeah, like maybe his father worked for the Governor General and was killed as a result.
And so he holds a special grudge against Alex because
of that.
Now that
she's been outed, yeah.
That's also a good theory.
Ooh.
You know,
that's spicy.
Other than that, there's not much to talk about from them being in J-Rock at this point. I made a note that Alex certainly has a lot more structure in her life now. Getting up at 6 a.m., to do exercises every week on certain days. They have to do inspections and uniform inspections. So She's going to have much less time to get herself in trouble, which I think is why Shirtlift wants her in the program to begin with. And overall, I think it's a good thing for Alex.
I think it'll be a good thing. It'll teach her, you know, to mind her manners or whatever. But the thing that's curious to me is we see Dean Graham kind of be reasonable. Like she says, oh, you guys are on probation. One more thing going wrong. You're going to be suspended. And you're thinking to yourself, compared to last year, that's a pretty reasonable punishment, I would say, especially given the fact that Anna basically hired a hitman against Tomo and, you know, Tomo ripped her fingernails off. So that kind of stuff. But then, and Tomo is excused at the sixth grade dean, whatever. Which, by the way, why was Alex never done that? You know, why didn't she do that with Alex in the first book? Then Dean Grimm says, okay, guys, now that Tomo's gone and I've saved face with her a little bit, it's either I suspend you guys or you join this military organization. Your choice.
And it's not really a choice, right?
The biggest thing is like she kind of twists her arm into doing it, which is kind of a strange thing in my opinion. Like we're kind of back to the last book, I guess, in the punishment manner.
I was going to say, Dean Grimm's attitude towards Alex has not changed at all.
No.
No.
Not at all. But there's not a lot going on in this arc, the J-Rock arc, at least in this chapter. And really, I think maybe the most interesting thing about this chapter is at the very end, Alex is up in her dorm with Anna and they're commiserating together about how terrible it is to be part of the J-Rock squad, and Charlie shows up and he's got something very interesting. Of course, Charlie has been stealing throughout this entire book, but this time he shows up and he's got a token with the letters MMS on the front, and on the back is a phrase, "If this coin be stolen, a thief's curse be upon you," on the back. And that's where the chapter ends. So that's where our discussion ends as well, but
spooky.
Very, very intriguing way to end this chapter, for sure. It's a big time hook for the next one.
Yeah, initially I thought, oh, this kind of sounds like Ozarker kind of dialect a little bit. But then I was like, oh, MMS. And then I thought back, and I don't know how I picked this up. But then I was like, oh, the Mors Mortem Society, or whatever it's called. Mors Mortis Society. So I wonder if it has something to do with that. But it's also fitting because I accidentally scrolled down and the next chapter is called that. So, oops.
That's where these chapters end. And we spent way more time on chapter 4 than chapter 5, but chapter 4 had so much
packed
into it.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you go back to the school, I mean, it's going to be a pretty big chapter, right? Things change over 3 months.
It is, yeah. And so
one noticeable difference is that it seemed like a lot more time went by. Like, I feel like this time a few weeks went by instead of one day in a chapter, which is not a bad thing.
No, I mean, Inverarity does write that way sometimes anyways, just seeing big chunks of time go past. And that helps us get through the school year a little bit quicker. But looking at the time, we should move into our extra segments right now. And so the first thing I'd like to do is I would like to rename the arc. As we did a couple weeks ago, we take these chapters and we give them one name, if this was one big book chapter. And so, Baylor, why don't you go ahead and start?
All right. So I thought that this was my biggest takeaway. I know Anna had her whole thing. My biggest takeaway was this basically them getting drafted into the military or get expelled from school. Choice that they had. And so for the arc, I renamed it Huckstein Wants You for the U.S. Army.
It would be interesting if he's the one pulling the strings about getting her into this little militia thing that she's joined in now.
That would be interesting, yeah. That wasn't what I was getting at, but if that does happen to be the case, that's definitely what I was getting
okay.
at.
Okay. Delver, what did you rename the Ark?
Clicks with a Q.
Yeah, sure.
To specify.
Ah, well, it is kind of like high school clicks, except for a little bit more impactful.
Well, we've got the cultures, of course. The Japanese, the Chinese, the Native Americans get mentioned. But we've also got this Mors Mortis Society clique going on. We've got the Storm Crows going on. We've got the
Spew,
thank mm-hmm. you, going on. So, I mean, we've got a lot of different groups based on a lot of different things.
Sure. I think it's fitting as well. My name for the Ark is Enter the Magikai, which is what I think would be a fun name for a movie.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that is kind of a cool culture name, Magikai.
It is cool. I like it.
Magikai?
And I like yeah. it also because Tomo, I think, must be the only Japanese student at the school.
Only one we've seen so far. Only one Anna's seen so far.
And I think it's fun to refer to her as the Magikai as if she's like this legendary figure.
Right.
Absolutely.
So now that we've named the Ark, we also need to go through our Ark MVPs. I'll start because once again I cheated and named the MVP before either of you guys had the document. But my MVP of this arc was our newest character, Tomo Matsuzaka. I think self-explanatory. Her actions towards Anna turned Anna into a much different person, perhaps a would-be murderer. And so that's enough impact for me to make her the most valuable person in this discussion.
Definitely.
Delbert, who was your ARC MVP?
Oh, I went with new custodian and certified de-jinxer. No, I'm kidding. I went with Shirtlift, actually, because she intervenes in the first chapter. Alex is missing that parental or authority figure that she likes. And it seems by every account in these two chapters that Shirtlift is going to be a lot more present in her life than she was in book one.
That is one thing that I didn't even think about when you brought that up, was the fact of how much more prevalent Shirtlift will be, because we'll be dealing with the J-Rock in, I'm assuming, almost every chapter. So that's kind of exciting.
That's exactly what I was going to say, too, is that because Alex is part of the J-Rock now, it's a guarantee we're going to see more of Shirtlift this time. Baylor, who was your ARC MVP?
So my MVP was actually Alexandra Quick, and the reason why is because when the whole battle broke out, I'll start with the first off, she kind of felt the treatment that she subjected her friends to last book, which was they're making plans behind her back and not telling her about them, and kind of sneaking around. But also, too, during the fight, instead of, I think old Alex would have gone in and been like, oh, I need to defend my friend, and started attacking Tomo and making the fight worse. I think that Alex showed a lot of maturity and growth by breaking up the fight and disarming them and trying to do everything she could to not make things worse than they already were. So that's why she was my ARC MVP.
I agree with everything you said. I think just the fact that she tried to do the right thing alone was impactful enough to put her in this discussion.
Oh, yeah.
So with that taken care of, Baylor, why don't you remind us about your prediction from a couple episodes ago?
I think we will be taking a deep dive into Anna's culture. I also think we will finally, because of this, we will finally get an answer to why Anna's dad is the way he is towards Muggles, especially given his mom is a Muggle. Then I think in a public display, the Confederation will declare war, or not necessarily declare war, but make their intentions known that they will be putting all of their reinforcements towards catching Abraham Thorne and the members of the Thorne Circle. And in order to do so, they will be recruiting new I don't know what they're called in America, Orrs, Wizarding Justice Officials, Mr. Thiels, I don't know. But I think they'll be recruiting, they will be recruiting new wands for the Special Inquisitorial Squad and the Wizarding Justice Department.
All right, that's Baylor's prediction about chapters 4 and 5. As a reminder, we're going to grade this, Delver, on a scale of 1 to 10. 1 being it was so bad you wouldn't even have your worst enemy listen to it. 5 being it was good, but like, eh. And 10 being...
5 being average?
10 being it's the greatest prediction you've ever heard anybody make about anything.
Cool, let's start it off. I'm giving it a 3.
I was going to give it a 3 as well, actually. We're on the same page here. I think because it felt like it was broken into 4 parts, and only one of those parts really hit, and that being the part where we learn more about Anna's culture.
Yeah, and even then, it's the only thing we learn is just that they feud with the Magi.
Now, what I will say is if we do indeed find out that it is Huxtine requesting Alex be part of the J-Rock squad, I'll come back and give this like a 7.
True, because that's pretty far out there.
For sure.
Yeah.
So if that happens, we'll come back to it. But for now, the sliding scale of Baylor's predictions is at a 3 overall.
Unlucky.
Bummer. Yeah, it's all right. It is what it is.
Baylor, now we need you to make a prediction for our discussion, our next discussion. And I've been looking pretty hard at what our next discussion should cover. And it seems to me that our next discussion should probably cover chapters 6, 7, and 8. I don't know that you've read it yet, Baylor, so you'll just have to trust me on that. But as we did,
I have not,
for your last prediction, I'm going to tell you the chapter titles of the 3 chapters, and then you're going to be allowed to ask a question of me and a question of Delbert. Right. So, chapter 6 is titled The Mors Mortis Society. Chapter 7 is titled Threats. And chapter 8 is titled Snakes in the Grass. What are your questions?
Ooh. Let's see. I'll ask Delbert. Does Alex join the Mors Mortis Society?
In time.
Interesting. All right. Brady is the antagonist, the main antagonist of the story. Are they revealed in the next 3 chapters?
No.
Okay. I don't know what that did for me, but I did something. So firstly, Alex will have to deal with the Thief's Curse thing, and I also think that the Thief's Curse won't be on her. I think it'll be on Charlie, because he's the one who actually stole the coin. But she will have to go to the Mors Mortis Society and confront them, and probably go through their induction ceremony, you know, their induction process. But I don't think she'll join the society at this time, just based on what you said, Delbert. I think that Maximilian King will come out as an enemy of Alex and will attempt to threaten to get her kicked out of J-Rock and potentially get kicked out of school. And then I also think someone who Alex has trusted, who trusts now or will start to trust in chapter 6 or 7, will become a traitor in chapter 8.
Okay.
Awesome prediction. And now that you've made it, I'd like to amend my answer to yes.
Objection? Hearsay?
Okay. Well, listen, I haven't read ahead again, so I wasn't sure. I knew there was some sort of stuff, but I gave a pretty unclear answer.
We will...
So it is a yes?
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get better at this prediction thing. We'll prepare a little bit more, but with your prediction being done, I think that's it. Do you guys have anything else to say?
Apologies to Baylor for giving him the wrong answer, letting him predict, and then changing it.
It's par for the course. The prediction segment has always been a total car crash. So, all right. Well, with that being said, that's it for our discussion on Chapter 4 and 5 of Alexander Quick and the Lands Below. Next week, we don't have a special episode planned, so it will be our discussion on Chapters 6, 7, and 8 of Alexander Quick and the Lands Below. As always, we appreciate you listening. Give us a review, please, if you haven't already done so. Otherwise, I've been Brady.
I've been Delbert.
I've been Baylor.
We'll see you next Sunday.
Woo!
Good night.
Hearsay.
Deuces.